So it's the 27th session. One more session left, right? So a couple of things before I start on today's last topic. The first, of course, your project is due on Monday at 5. Keep moving. Don't get stuck, right? So it's going to, you know, that's the key. It's incremental and you got to keep moving. So even if you're just starting, if you keep moving, you'll get done. So it's been done before. Don't try to change companies on Saturday, please. I know a couple of you will get frustrated with your company. I'm going to change companies. It's not a great idea to do it in that last weekend. And try to get together as a group before you actually start. At least once get together as a group before you actually submit your final project report. Okay. After class today, I will send you as an attachment to the email. And today, please don't trash my emails before you even read them, which I know some of you do. This attachment actually is critical because it's a summary sheet where I will ask you for numbers on your company. And I'll list out the numbers for Disney so you can see exactly what I'm looking for. And I'd like you to send me that summary sheet back by Sunday because Monday's class is going to be all about your company so you can see what you found. Okay? So let's get started. We're going to talk about valuation today. Okay? How many of you have had a chance to try valuing your companies? Come on, you can put your hand. I'm not going to ask you about your valuation, so don't worry. So a few have. Okay? So today we're going to talk about valuation, and in the process, this is as much going to be about finance as it's going to be about philosophy and psychology. And you're going to see what I mean by that. Because in valuation, you're leaving all your comfort zones. Because up till now, whenever there's a number, what do? You point to somebody else. That's why you're using that beta. It came off your website, not my fault. If I ask you, what's that debt? It came off the 10K. It came from valuation. You have to leave those comfort zones and make judgments about your company. And here's the problem. Is when you make those judgments, what's the first reaction you have? Is how do I know I'm right? The answer is you don't. And you've got to be okay with that. That's the psychological part. And that's why a lot of people can never do valuation because psychologically they can never leave that shoreline where they're attached to the numbers, but you really have to do it. And you're going to see me struggle with my companies as I go through my valuations. And I'm going to let you see me sweat. Not sweat in the physical sense, that's disgusting. But sweat in the sense of how do I come up with inputs when I'm having issues with a company. Justin, what's the point of valuing a company? Does somebody want to answer that question? What are the points? Why do we value companies? Come on. Because it's part of the project. I know, that's take that off the list. What else? Roy. First is if you want to acquire a company, you need to know the value of the company. What else? If you're an investor, you might be interested, but could you finish the story? You're interested in value because you have an inherent faith that price will, not only that it's undervalued, but that the market will correct to that value. So if you're an investor, what else? You're the CEO of a company. Do you care about the value of your company? What's your objective in corporate finance? Maximize the value of the company. If you don't know where the value comes from, how do you connect the actions you take? So one of the things we're going to do as we go through this valuation is I'm going to tie valuation back to everything in this class. And I'm going to say, remember that investment decision a long time ago? This is where it shows up in value. That financing decision, this is why we care. It's going to give you essentially a way of bringing together everything in this class into one number. It's almost magical because every single action that every business takes ultimately has an effect on value. So let me start this process off by going back to what we were talking about last session. We're talking about growth, right? And remember what I said. I don't have the power to endow your company with high growth. You got to earn it. And I talked about this way of estimating growth where you take how much you reinvest and how well you reinvest and come up with the product. So today I want to get a little more specific about that concept. I said if you are looking at equity earnings, you measure how much you reinvest by looking at how much of your net income you put back into the business, and you look at how well you reinvest by looking at your return on equity. So let me take Deutsche Bank, which is one of the companies I'm going to value today. And I'm going to take you back to 2008. Remember, this is before the crisis when things look great for banks. And I decide to estimate a growth for Deutsche Bank using this very simple equation. So how much I reinvest is what I put back into the business, right? So in 2007, which is the most recent year for Deutsche, when I was doing my valuation in 2008, their return on equity was about 19.45%. They made a lot of money in 2007, like most of the banks. And their retention ratio was about 67%. So for every $100 in net income, they put 67 cents back, or $67 back. If they were able to maintain those numbers, 67% retention ratio and 19.5% return equity going forward. Those are extraordinarily good numbers. Their expected growth rate in the future will be about 13.04%. So if they can maintain their 2007 numbers. So put yourself back in 2008. You're sitting there. Banks look great. They're making a lot of money. And if you have no perspective, if your entire world starts with last year, know what's going to happen, right? You're going to take last year. You're going to assume that every year is going to be like last year. And this is really not even a valuation. If every year was like 2007, would banks be worth a lot of money? Of course. Just like if you took an oil company and I took 2011 earnings and I said, if every year was a year when oil prices go up $25, why am I even wasting my time doing a valuation? You're worth a lot of money. So here's what I did to kind of temper myself. I said, okay, 2007 was a good year, but there were years before 2007, right? Like 2006 and 2005 and 2004 and 2003. I looked at what the return on equity and retention ratio were if I looked at a five-year period. And the return on equity over that five-year period was 11.81%, lower than the 19.45% because there was one bad year, one average year, things kind of muddled along. And the retention ratio over that period was about 45.7%. So both the return on equity and the retention ratio were much lower. If those are the numbers that are the best numbers for the future, the expected growth rate I will have for Deutsche, if you take the product of those two numbers, is 5.4%. Now do you see why two people can value the same company and end up with different values? If you looked at Deutsche in 2008 and said, this is the way the world is going to be going forward, banks are going to make tons of money and reinvest a lot, you should use the 13% to get a much higher value. But if you feel that this too shall pass, the things averaged out, your growth rate is going to be low and the value is going to be lower. Griffin? Why 5 years? Why not? Why not 10? Why not 7? Why not 9? I'll give you the kind of intellectual answer, but I almost never follow my own intellect on this one. You want to get enough of a period that you get good years and bad years. If I'm looking at a cyclical company where cycles often take, 10, 15 years, I want to go back a long period. Whereas if you're looking at a less cyclical sector where you just have good years and bad years, you have a good trading year and a bad trading year, you can go back shorter. So with a bank, I don't feel the urge to go back 15 years because there's a trade-off. If I go back too far in time, I get more data. But what's the disadvantage? The company itself is changing, right? Deutsche in the early 90s might not look anything like Deutsche in 2007. So I don't want to go back too far if the company is shifting. And banks were shifting so much in the last decade, I was wary about going back to the 1990s. Maya, you had a question? No, okay. No? Okay. Now that I know people's names, I can put them on the spot. In the front row, I kind of have all the names. So that's the danger of sitting in the front row, I guess. Now, I notice people are going further and further back. Don't worry, if you're past the third row, I have no idea who you are. Okay. So now let's talk about Tata Motors. So in the Deutsche valuation, you're going to see my 5.4% growth rate, and you've seen my justification. So I turn to Tata Motors. Here I don't want to use the dividend discount model. Why? Because dividends are when you're desperate, right? I can estimate cash flows. So rather than trust you to tell me when I don't pay dividends, I'm reinvesting the money, I can see what you actually reinvest. So in Tata Motors, I looked at the reinvestment rate, where I took the CapEx and the change in working capital, and I looked at what percentage of the net income you put back into the business. And for Tata Motors, if you look at the numbers, now do you see why I want to average things out at a company like Tata Motors? In 2008 and 2009, they actually had a negative reinvestment rate because they actually lost money but reinvested money anyway. And if you look across the 5 years, my aggregated reinvestment rate across the 5 years was about 88%. What does that tell me? During this five-year period, with up years and down years, Tata Motors reinvested 88% in what? In new plant and equipment, new acquisitions, working capital. Everything is in that reinvestment. Now, last session, I showed you the 88%. I asked you, is that a good number or a bad number? And I think somebody said it depends. Depends on what? What kind of return on equity they earned over that period. And the return on equity they earned over the period was all over the place. And at least based on the accounting numbers, it looks like their return on equity is 43%. I don't believe it for a second. And some of you are going to run into the same thing. When you compute the return on invested capital or return on equity in your company, look at the numbers and say, no way, 173%. You know why you should be wary of this number? It's an accounting number. So any crazy things I do with the invested capital or the operating income are going to show up as strange-looking returns on equity and capital. But to the extent that I go with that number, I'm going to get this astonishingly high growth rate, because 88% times 43% gives me a growth rate of 38% a year for the next 5 years. And here again, I went back to basics. I basically took out the numbers that I thought were strange-looking accounting numbers. That brought my return on equity down to about 29.97%, because by 2013, one of the reasons the return on equity numbers was so strange is the acquisition they did of Jaguar Land Rover in 2009 did all kinds of damage. Like what? It created a goodwill number. And for those of you who have goodwill in your companies, you know how much trauma this creates in the return on invested capital stage, right? Because remember that spreadsheet would ask you, how much of your goodwill do you want me to keep in the invested capital? And you had no idea, because it would be any number from 0 to 100, and what you chose affected it. So the advantage by the time I got to 2013 is the acquisition had finally took 4 years to play itself out. So the 2013 number that I got was about 30% return equity. It's still high, at least did not have the acquisition hangover in it. And the reinvestment rate they had in 2013 was 80.5%. With Tata Motors, I'm actually going to go with the 2013 numbers. Now do you see why I create no rules in valuation? Because I break my own rules all the time. There is no rule in valuation. We always use five-year numbers. If it works for your company, use a five-year number. For your company, last year is a much better indicator. Use last year's numbers. And already you can see with Deutsche, I'm going to use a five-year average. But with Tata Motors, I'm going to go with last year's numbers. Okay. Now let's back up. So basically what I'm saying is, if you have a high return on equity, you're going to have a high growth in equity earnings, right? There are two ways you can end up with a really high return on equity. The first is the old-fashioned way. You go take great projects. That's how Google ends up with a high return on equity. But that's so much work. Here's the second way you can end up with a high return equity. You take average projects, and then you use debt to pump up your return equity. You're saying, what the hell are you talking about? What's the advantage of borrowing money? It's a fixed rate. You get a tax advantage. By the time it's all done, and many of you, I hope most of you, have computed the cost of capital for your companies. Did you take a look at the after-tax cost of debt for your company? Notice how small it was, right? 2.5, 3. So basically, you're borrowing money at 2, 2.5, or 3%. Here's how you as an equity investor can benefit from that. Let's say your projects make 10%. It's not great, right? 10%. But if you borrow half the money you need for the project at 3%, you can make 10% of the project. Guess who gets to keep the other 7%? You do as an equity investor. In fact, algebraically, the return on equity for a company can be written as a return on invested capital. That's the base. So if you took no debt at all, the two numbers would be the same, plus the leverage effect. And the leverage effect is captured by looking at how much debt you take on for every dollar of equity. That's a debt to equity ratio. And what benefit you get from borrowing money, which is the difference between what you make on your projects and what you have to pay out in debt. So you can take average projects and make your return on equity look really, really good because you used a lot of debt. So I'm going to put you on the spot. Let's suppose you're an investor looking at a company. The company has a 15% return on invested capital. So if it took no debt at all, its return on equity would also be 15%. But it's borrowed a dollar of debt for every dollar of equity. Its debt to equity ratio is 100%. And let's say its after-tax cost of debt is 5%. You don't need a calculator for this. Tell me what the return on equity will be for this company. So if it takes no debt, the return on equity would have been 15, but you borrowed a dollar of debt for every dollar of equity, and you're paying only 5% after taxes as your cost of debt, what's it going to be? It's going to be 25%. Plug in the numbers. 15% debt to equity is 1. 15 minus 5 in the denominator, in the brackets. So you've taken 15% projects and delivered a 20. This is good, right? You have a 25% return equity. But let's say as an investor, you're trying to pick between this company and another company, which has a 25% return equity because it took great projects and uses no debt. They both will look the same on a return equity basis. They both will look the same in terms of a growth basis if they're paying out exactly the same amount in dividends. So here's my final question. If they have the same return equity and the same growth, will they have the same value? Will you attach the same value to their equity? Griffin, why not?
One's taking great projects and the other levering up.
So how will you punish them? It's a mechanical question. Where in your valuation will you reflect the fact that the first company uses debt and the second company doesn't? Maya? No, you can't, because it's an equity valuation, but you're close. What do I discount the cash flows to equity at? A cost of equity. And what do I use to get a cost of equity? A beta. And that beta is a? Levered beta. So these two companies can be in the same business, same growth rate. But when I do the levered beta for the first company, I'm going to be using a debt to equity ratio of 100%. And when I do the debt to equity ratio for the second company, I'm going to use a debt to equity ratio of 0%. Your beta for the second company will be lower than the beta for the first company. So even though they look alike in terms of growth and return equity, the value of equity for that second company will be much higher than the value of equity for the first company, but only if you're careful and adjust your beta for leverage. And that's part of the reason I've almost been fixated on this notion of adjusting your cost of equity for risk, because if you don't, you're going to fall into what I call the classic real estate problem. What I mean by the classic real estate problem, in real estate, people love to borrow money to pump up their returns on equity. Because a building by itself might have a 6% return, but with 400% debt, that's going to look like 21%. And you say, that's a great return on equity. But remember, with a 400% debt to equity ratio, your cost of equity has also risen. The net effect is what you should be looking at. So be careful when you borrow money, because that borrowing will make your return on equity look high. But that return equity will not necessarily translate into a high value for equity, because your cost of equity will also go up. Any questions? Now let's talk about what to do if you're looking at operating income. So though Deutsche and Tata Motors, I was looking at equity. I was focused on what equity gets reinvested and what the return equity was, right? With Disney, I'm going to value the entire business. So here, rather than focusing on how much of the net income gets reinvested, I looked at how much of the after-tax operating income gets reinvested. So in this case, basically, I jumped a page. Okay. So I'm going to take the after-tax operating income for Disney, which is $10,032 million net of the taxes. That's what the 1 minus 0.3102 is. And I'm going to divide the net capex, that's the $3.629 billion plus the depreciation. That's the total amount I reinvested back in the company. I get a reinvestment rate of 53.93%. Again, that's a number I did last session, so that's how much they're reinvesting. They're reinvesting about 54% of their after-tax operating income back. And when I look at what kind of returns they're making, I no longer focus on just the equity slice, I look at the total invested capital. And the return on invested capital that Disney had, with all the qualifiers about it being an accounting number, was 12.61%. Again, if I assume, and this is where you're leaving the past and going into the future, if I assume they can maintain those two numbers, and it's a big if, 53.93% times 12.61%, the reinvestment rate times the return on capital, gives me an expected growth rate for Disney of 6.8%. In my Disney valuation, that's what you're going to see, is a 6.8% growth rate. The growth comes from my assumption that they can keep reinvesting the way they have and earn the same returns on capital that they have. So how do I know they're going to be able to do that? I don't. That's why it's an assumption. That's why you could look at Disney and make a very different judgment. Today, I'll be quite honest, when I value Disney going forward, the return on capital I might use going forward will be lower than the return on capital last year. You know why? Why? What's the worry that Disney has now that they did not have in 2013? ESPN? That's their biggest money machine. In 2013, it looked like the gift that would keep on giving, because where would people go without cable? And of course, you have Hulu and Netflix and people cutting their cord to cable. It's affecting ESPN's revenue. So when I do my forecast for the future, I might say, you earned a 15% return on capital in 2015, but I think it's going to drop to 13, 13 and a half, 12, depending on how pessimistic I am about the future. So any questions on this equation, reinvestment rate times return on capital? It's an incredibly powerful equation. It's a great way to keep your valuation consistent. But it works only if your company has a return on capital that is sustainable. That's why it's called a sustainable growth rate. Yep. Once you go open the door, you can't shut it. That's it. From the time you did the lease conversion to debt in the cost of capital, step three, the pathway is laid out. From that point in time, every time you talk about debt, it should include the lease commitments as well. Okay. Now, this will work if you have a company with a return on capital that's settled down. As opposed to what? As opposed to a company where margins are changing over time. What kinds of companies would margins change over time? One is if you have a young company that's evolving over time, right? Young companies initially will lose money, but as they move through time, assuming they succeed, their margins should increase. Or it could be a decaying company, a JCPenney, where the margins are good right now, but as Amazon keeps eating away their business, the margins can decrease. If your expected margins can change over time, which is going to be the case a lot of the time, you can't use the equation that I went through. You actually have to go back to the very top line. The top line for any business is what? You got to start with revenues. You got to project out revenues. So what I'm going to lay is a template that I find is the most general way of valuation. You give me a startup that doesn't have a dollar in the ground, this is the approach I will give. You give me a mature company with lots of stuff on the ground, I'll use this approach. You give me a decaying company, and this is actually the basis for that valuation spreadsheet that I sent you. So as I go through this, you're going to see the pieces of that spreadsheet come in front of you and say, oh, that's why I use that number. So the first step I'm going to ask you to go through is estimate what revenues will be in the future. In other words, take your revenues today and tell me how those revenues will grow into the future. What's that going to depend on? It depends on what business you're in. It'll depend on how big the market is. It depends on how good your product is. You see, all those are qualitative factors. Of course, you have to bring those all in. That's the first step. So if you have a startup that you have, like Abby does or anybody else has, start thinking, what's the total market? What will my revenues be in this market? That's the first step in the process, revenues over time. But revenues alone don't deliver value, right? Ultimately, what do you have to do? You have to make money. So I know you're not going to make money right now. You're a startup. But you have to tell me what margin you will evolve towards over time. So right now, you might say, I lose 30% of my revenues. But you keep losing 30% of your revenues in perpetuity, you're worth nothing. So tell me whether that's going to become 8, 10, 12, 15, and that'll again depend on what business you're in, what your cost structure looks like, what pricing you've decided to adopt. So start with revenues, project out margins. And there's one loose end you've got to tie up to make this valuation consistent. You're trying to make small revenues into big revenues, right? That's not going to happen by itself. You've got to tell me how much you will have to reinvest back in the business to make your revenue grow. And here's the metric I'm going to use to make that judgment. I'm going to take revenues and divide it by invested capital. You're saying, what's that going to tell me? Let's say that number is 4. Here's what I'm telling you. Every additional dollar that you put into business creates $4 in revenues. If that is the case, I'm going to look at your change in revenue from year to year. Use that to back out how much you will need to reinvest. Now, Baidu is not a startup, but I'm going to show you how these numbers look like for Baidu, and you can start thinking about what they will look like for Twitter or Snapchat. Or even further down the cycle, you could take young startups and think about how these processes will play out. So here are my projections for Baidu. Baidu, as you know, search engine, dominates the Chinese market, has very little competition. First step in the process, I project revenue growth. And I have a pretty healthy revenue growth. For a company that's fairly large, I'm putting in a 25% revenue growth for the next 5 years. Why am I so optimistic? Because the Chinese market is a growing market. And they dominate the market, and Google's not going to be let to come in. You get a 25% growth rate. Big market, even though they're a big company, they're going to be able to live off the growth of the market. So the small revenues become big revenues. So over time, the $28.8 billion revenues grow over the next 10 years to $154 billion revenues. Second step is I've got to project out what will happen to the profit margins. And here, unlike a startup where you're starting with negative margins and improving over time, here they're actually starting with astonishingly high margins, almost 48.7% in margins. That's, you know, you look at most sectors, that would be a stratospheric margin. But competition is starting to come in, not from non-China, actually from within China. You're starting to see other companies try to take away their online advertising. It could be Alibaba, it could be Tencent. So essentially that competition is going to put pressure on them, and that part of the story means their margins are going to decrease over time. Every valuation, there's an underlying story. What's the story I'm telling you about Baidu? It's an optimistic story of revenue growth with more competition around the corner. And along the way for their revenues to grow, I'm going to estimate how much they will have to reinvest by looking at the change in revenue every year and dividing by that sales to capital ratio that I talked about. And the way to read the 2.64 is for every dollar in capital they invest, they get $2.64 in additional revenues. So revenue growth, margins, reinvestment. Question?
Yeah, how did you get the 35%?
Well, I looked at the margins for Google, which is in a comparative marketplace. And Google's an incredibly profitable company. Its margins are about 35%. Right now, Baidu makes well above that because they have almost no competition. They don't have to worry about anybody else eating their lunch. But that's starting to change. So I'll take my information from wherever I can. Okay? And in this case, that's a 35% that's driving my margins. Yes, Roy? It's an online advertising business. So it's a search engine is how they get the online advertising revenue. You know what I tied it to? I tied it to the growth of online retailing in China. That's what the projected growth was in 2013, is the overall online retailing market in China, which already was the second largest in 2013, was projected to grow 25% a year. So all I'm saying is keep up with the market, not even get a bigger share of the market. So all they're doing is keeping up with the size of the online retail market, because that's where you get your advertising. So that's the 25%. Let me put it this way. I foresee lots of ways I can be wrong, but I don't know which direction. And when that's the case, let it go. There's this, I call this karmic uncertainty, which is at some point you've got to say, it's out of my control, I'm going to let it go. I'll give you an example. You value a U.S. company today. Interest rates are 1.8%. They're really low, right? They could go up. They could go down. I know they can change. But if I don't have a sense of direction, I'm going to just say, okay, that's it. So basically, there are some things where you have a sense of direction, you put that in, and some things where you just have to say, I know it's going to change, but I don't know which direction, I'm going to let it go. Right? So those are the numbers that are going to drive my ultimate valuation. Yes?
Should you look at estimating margins, or should you look at estimating revenue growth?
Both. One without the other is useless, right? Oh, start with revenue growth because they're tied together, right? Because to grow your revenues faster, you often have to be more aggressive in your pricing. If you're more aggressive in your pricing, your margins go down. So rather than think of where I start and where I, it's not sequential, right? So you can start with revenue growth, and given your revenue growth, you're already set in a margin policy that you're going to have. So what you want to do is make sure you're not inconsistent. What would be inconsistent? You have massive revenue growth, and then you tell me your margins will quadruple beyond the competition, and I'm going to say, well, that's nice, but how are you pulling this off? So internally, it's important that you be consistent rather than think about which comes first and which comes second. Because it's a spreadsheet. You can do them first and then second and go back to the first, right? You can go back and forth until you feel okay with what you projected. Any questions on growth? Which brings me to the fourth and final input. So we talked about cash flows, we've talked about discount rates, we've talked about growth. Let's close the process. You project cash flows, at some point in time you have to stop. Why? Because nobody can project cash flows forever. You stop and you estimate that value that you think this business will have 5 years from now or 10 years from now. That's called the terminal value. And there are three ways of estimating terminal value. One should never be used, but it gets used all the time. I'll come back to it. But there are two legitimate ways of estimating terminal value in an intrinsic valuation. One is to use a stable growth rate forever, right? Infinite growth, perpetual growth model. What do you think the other legitimate way of entering it, of estimating terminal value is? That's the one way I don't want you to use. So let's go to the other way. Is there any other way of getting a terminal value? Again, pricing. So we'll talk about, in fact, this is, when you go to investment banks, they say, use EBITDA multiples from comparables, use, you know, we'll come back and talk about why that should never be used in a terminal value. And it's not your fault. Everybody does it. What other way could you do? Do companies have to last forever? Yeah, what if you ran a restaurant and it's got a 20-year lease? At the end of 20 years, you can say, I'm going to liquidate it. Take the liquidation value of the assets, say what you'll get. And what that liquidation value will be will vary across businesses, right? You have a technology business, the liquidation value could be nothing. You have a mine that you exhaust, the liquidation value could be worse than nothing. You might be facing costs to clean up the mine. Or if you have physical assets, you're a real estate company, your liquidation value could be a pretty big number. A liquidation value is you have a finite life business. Perpetual growth model is if you have a going concern. Now let me come back and talk about why using multiples in terminal value can get you into trouble. First, let's take a multiple approach. You'd say, you know, 10 years from now, I'm going to apply a multiple. Let's pick a number, 6 times EBITDA to get my terminal value. First, where do you usually get these numbers for multiples? Where do you come up with that 6? What do you do usually as a banker? Yes. You look at other companies in the sector. You look at how they're priced. And you say, typically, companies in the sector are priced at 6 times EBITDA. I'm going to take the 6 times EBITDA and apply it to my year 10 EBITDA. You say, what's wrong with that? Nothing wrong with it, but it's a pricing, right? Remember we talked about the distinction between pricing and valuation? I call these Trojan horse DCFs. Anybody remember the legend of the Trojan horse? So, of course, you know, thousands of years ago, these Trojans, this is actually a group of people called Trojans. I don't know what they're called now. I think they're all at USC maybe. Okay. So they have this own country. It's Troy. They have the city. And the Greeks have laid siege to the city. And these sieges, in those days, they must have had nothing to do, no Netflix to watch. So the sieges lasted years and years and years. It's boring. Have a siege. So 5 years in, the siege is still a siege, which is the people inside the city are still inside the city. The people outside the city are still outside the city. So the people in the city are the Trojans. The people outside the city are the Greeks. So 5 years, on the 5th year's anniversary, maybe, the Greeks give a gift to the Trojans. Why you would accept a gift from somebody who's been trying to invade you for 5 years, I don't know. But I guess this is the origin of the thing, beware of Greeks bearing gifts. Because the gift they give the Trojans is a big wooden horse. What are you going to do with a big wooden horse again? I have no idea. So this big wooden horse get wheeled into the city. The Trojans close the doors again and say, those nice Greeks, they gave us a gift. And they wheel the wooden horse to the side and leave it for the night. And in the middle of the night, the back of the wooden horse opens. And these Greek soldiers come out of the wooden horse and the city falls. What's this got to do with DCF valuation? The essence of intrinsic valuation is all supposed to be about cash flows, growth, and risk, right? So while I'm distracted by your cash flows for the next 5 years, what do? You open the back of the horse. You slide in a 6 times EBITDA into your terminal value. That's it. That's driving your entire valuation. This has nothing to do with intrinsic valuation. So if any of you are going to work in investment banks, this is what you're going to be doing and calling valuation. And if I ever catch one of your valuations, I'm just going to call you and say, don't call it a valuation, just call it a forward pricing. That's what it is. Nothing more, nothing less, nothing bad about it, but it's a pricing. So if you use the going concern version of the model, then the way you get the value is you take the cash flows 1 year later. So basically, if you stop at year 5, to get the terminal value in year 5, you get the cash flow in year 6. Why? Because that's the way present value equations always work. You need 1 year forward. And then you divide by the difference between your discount rate and your growth rate. The perpetual growth model. It's the most used and misused equation in finance. I might have used this analogy before, but I'll use it again. You look at that equation, you can see why when you're an analyst wanting to pump up the value of a company, this is the place you go, right? Look at the equation. You got too low a value for your company. What number in that equation are you going to mess with to push your value up? Look at the denominator. What do you have? R minus G, right? So let's say your growth is 2%. You push it up to 2.25%. What's going to happen? Your value is going to get bigger. Not big enough? Try 2.5. How about 2.75? 3.25. 3.5. Keep going. You're going to have what I call Buzz Lightyear valuations to infinity and beyond. Do you see where you're going, right? R goes towards G. Your terminal value becomes this infinite number. Your value explodes into the stratosphere. That's why I'm going to put some rules on this terminal value to keep it from running away from you, because if you don't watch it, the number will take over your valuation. So here's the first question you have to deal with when you do valuation. I give you a company to value. You have to decide at what point in time you're going to make it a going concern. This terminal value equation. What point in time you're going to give it this growth rate in perpetuity? And my only advice is don't wait too long. What do I mean by that? Not all companies are going to become mature companies at the same point in time. Some companies might already be mature companies. Don't dance around them. This is it, you're done. Some companies might have 3, 4, 5 years of growth before they become mature companies. Some might have 10, maybe even more, before they become mature companies. You're saying, how do I know which one mine is? Here are some very simple things to look at. One is look at the size of your company relative to the market that it serves. Let me give you an example. I ask you to value Volkswagen. How many years of high growth do you think Volkswagen has left in it? It's already the largest market share company in a business that's not growing very much, the auto business. I'd be surprised if there's any high growth left. So if you told me I'm valuing Volkswagen and I think it's already a mature company, I'm not going to contest you. It's a large company in a mature market. Think of that as one extreme. Let me stay in that same market and ask you, what do you think about Tesla? Now, you and I can debate how great or bad Elon Musk is, but Tesla sold 25,000 cars last year. 25,000. And this market is millions and millions of cars. So if in a valuation of Tesla, you said, I'm going to assume high growth for the next 10 years, I'm not going to contest you on that. It's a small company in a big market. So when you look at your company relative to the market serves. You can already see how careful you got to be on revenue growth. Because if you have a big company in a mature market, don't give me 15% revenue growth. Your company will end up becoming 110% of that market, and that's not feasible. Second, I'm going to look at your momentum. Momentum in what sense? If your revenue growth for the last 5 years has been 2% a year, and you tell me magically that you're going to have 10 years of high growth, I'm going to say, from where? What happened? Whereas in the last 5 years, you've had 80% growth a year in revenues, and you tell me you have high growth, you have a much better case to make. You're saying, why are you focused on revenues rather than income? Because people can play games with income. You can have a mature company report high growth in income because the accountants did some neat stuff. But revenue growth is very difficult to mess with. That's a number, that's a top line. So unless you're growing fast, that number can't grow. And so the third factor I'm going to look at. To make money off growth, what did we say you have to do? You have to earn a return on capital that is higher or lower than your cost of capital. A 50-50 shot. It's got to be higher than your cost of capital, right? That's the mathematics. But when we say a company has a return on capital higher than its cost of capital, we're also saying something about its competitive advantages and barriers to entry, right? Why? Because Nikon 101, remember when you made money, what happened in a perfectly competitive market? You make money in an instant, competition comes in. In other words, if you lived in a competitive marketplace, every company would earn its cost of capital because there'd be no way you could make more. So the flip side of that is when you come to me with a valuation and you tell me my company is going to have 10 years of high growth and earn a 25% return on capital and its cost of capital is only 10%. The question I'm not going to ask you is not how did you compute the return on capital? Did you include goodwill or not? The question I'm going to ask you is, what's so special about you? What's your comparative advantage? What are these barriers to entry? And if you say, well, I haven't thought of any, then I say, I don't believe you. This is where valuations get grounded, is when you ask those questions. And that's why in section 5, when I ask you to compute the return on capital, if you read the rest of the section, I ask you two questions. Why is the return on capital what it is? So if you found a 35% return on capital, and can the company sustain these returns? And it sounds like, so why are you asking me these questions? Lay the foundation when you get to the valuation where you can tell me, well, I think my company is special and I think it can maintain these 30% returns on capital. So that's the judgment that drives whether you use 0, 2, 3, 5, 7, or 10 before you put your company into stable growth. So let me show you the judgments I reach with my companies. With Disney, I started with a company in the market. It's one of the largest entertainment companies in the world in a big market. So that's kind of a strike against it growing fast. But it can maintain some growth because the market itself is growing, especially if you think globally. But it's not going to grow at 15, 20, 25%. That's clearly off the table. So if I'm lucky, maybe 5, 6%. Is it a company with special competitive advantages? What do you think, Disney? Yeah, it's very tough to think about how you replicate a Mickey Mouse or the kind of brand names that keep them afloat. So I feel pretty comfortable assuming that they can earn excess returns for a long time. So I gave them 10 years of high growth. Sounds like a long period, but much of that high growth was 6 to 7%. So I'm going to assume that they can grow barely above the growth rate of the economy, but for a long period because they have these competitive advantages that they can now use globally. So in my valuation of Disney, you're going to see a 10-year growth period. Then I turn to Vale. What does Vale do? It's a mining company. It's the biggest iron ore mining company in the world already. It's the third largest mining company in the world. There's no high growth that's going to come. In fact, if you have high growth, where's it going to come from? Iron ore prices have to go up. Commodity prices have to go up. So unless I want to make this a commodity price play, the revenue growth of this company is going to be pretty low because it's already one of the largest mining companies in the world. So in the case of Vale, I valued it as a stable growth company, a company that's already a mature company. You're not going to see high growth with Vale. Then I turned to Tata Motors. If I were valuing Tata Motors in 2008, I'd have probably made it a mature company. It was a big part of the Indian market. The Indian market was growing, but Tata Motors was really under assault in every direction. Its competitive advantages were fading. But the Jaguar Land Rover acquisition kind of changed them as a company for two reasons. One, it brought in global growth. And second, it brought in a competitive advantage that they'd never had before. Nobody ever buys a Tata car and says, I'm going to pay a premium. It's a Tata car. But a Jaguar Land Rover, I can charge you a premium price and you're willing to do it because it's a Land Rover or a Jaguar. So when I value Tata Motors, that acquisition is what's making the difference. I gave them a five-year growth period, not long growth period, because again, they're pretty, Jaguar Land Rover can grow only so much. So it's a five-year growth period. Then I turn to Baidu. So it dominates its market. That's a kind of a strike against it because it already has a high market share. But the market itself is growing 25% a year. And in a sense, it's got enforcement against competition from the government. Those factors played into why I gave Baidu a 10-year growth period. So again, think about the stories I'm telling about these companies, because what you're going to see as valuations will reflect those stories. So now I'm going to hit you with a few valuations. And as I go through these valuations, there are going to be lots of numbers coming at you. But kind of step back from the numbers and think about the story I'm telling about these companies. So let me start with Vale. I told you I want to value it as a mature company, right? So in a mature company, your growth rate is going to be a low growth rate. Did I jump a page? No. Yeah. So let me put in the growth rate, in this case, of 2% a year. So first thing I did was I went and looked at Vale's financials. I start with the most recent year, the trailing 12-month data, and their operating income was $15.487 billion. Then I started looking back over time. And I noticed that this was actually if you look at the history there, they went from 6 billion to 23 billion to 30 billion, and then they saw the drop back to 15 billion. So I said, I'm going to be careful about just using the last 12 months, because God only knows what I'm assuming. So I took the average operating income over those 5 years, and I got 17.6 billion. So file that away. Over the last 5 years, which is a really bad year in 2009 and a really bad year in 2012 and 13, their average operating income is 17.6 billion. I did the same thing for their tax rate. It jumps all over the place, 28, 18. I use the average tax rate. I'm essentially using the law of large numbers here. If a number moves around a lot, why focus on just the last year? Why not look at an average over time? And in the last column, I looked at the return on capital. And again, it climbs from 2009 to 2010 and 11 and then drops back again. And the average return on capital is 17.25%. I assume that those average numbers I got over the last 5 years were essentially the numbers that Vale could maintain going forward. Could I be wrong? God, was I horribly wrong in hindsight? And I'll kind of tell you what the ugly details were after this valuation. But at the time of the valuation, I felt pretty good about them. I needed a cost of capital to discount these cash flows, right? There, luckily, by the time I got to this stage, I'd already done my homework. Bottom-up beta, rating based upon S&P rating. I came up with a cost of capital of 8.2%. And also, I forgot to mention, I'm going to do the entire valuation in U.S. dollars. Why? Because it's a commodity company. It's easier for me to value it in dollars than do it in nominal reais. So here's how the valuation plays out. What I assumed as operating income is the average operating income over 5 years, 17.626 billion, not last year's operating income. What I assumed as a growth rate was a 2% growth rate forever, right? It's a mature company. Growth rate they can sustain forever. The cost of capital is 8.2%, the calculations are there. And there's one final input that I estimated. If this company is going to grow at 2% a year forever, and it has a 17.25% return on capital, which is my assumption, they will have to reinvest about 11.59%. So basically, if you think about growth as reinvestment rate times return on capital, I've just done the basic algebra and said, if I know what the growth rate is and what the return on capital is, what reinvestment rate would I need? That reinvestment rate is 11.59%. That becomes what I have to reinvest back to get the 2% growth. What I get as a value for the operating assets is $202.8 billion. I add cash, I subtract out debt. I get a value for the equity of $167 billion. I divide by the number of shares, I get $32.44 per share. Stock price then was $13. So ask me the question. Did I buy? I did, and I wish I hadn't. This is perhaps the worst investment I made in the last decade. The stock 6 months ago in Vale was $2, right? Thank God I didn't hold on all the way to the end. I actually sold at $5, and the post I wrote when I sold was the most painful post I ever wrote. Because I said, I screwed up. Let me take that back. I screwed up, and fate delivered a couple of blows that I could not have foreseen. Two things happened between 2013 and 2015. Between the $32 value and my valuation when I revalued it when the stock. See, what I do is I revalue the stock every 3 or 6 months. So for the first four go-rounds, the price kept dropping, but I revalued and the value stayed above the price. So I could at least say, look, you know, market's being crazy, but the value's higher than the price. Then I got to the $5 stock price and I revalued and the price went, the value that I got was $4.10 and the fig leaf was gone. So I said, you know what? If I were being consistent, buying the stock because it's undervalued, it's time for me to leave. In fact, the title of my post was No Mas, No Mas. And I got this blowback from Brazilian readers saying that's Spanish, you should have used Portuguese. I got all these translations for No Mas, No Mas. But the No Mas basically was an indication of I give up, it's capitulation time. And then I went back and looked at how my value went from 32 to 4. That's a big change, right, over a three-year period. Here are the things that happened, two of which were out of my control. I couldn't have done much about, but one I could have done something about. The first was the iron ore prices had dropped to $50 when I did this valuation, which I actually assumed would turn around. That's what the normalization did. Kept going down. They went down to 35. That I can't believe. That's, you know, out of my control. That's a commodity price. It's like buying an oil company at $70, it drops to 35. So that's, you know, I couldn't foresee. The Brazilian government, which in 2013 was viewed as the best of the Latin American governments in terms, you know, that's history now. So, you know, by 2015 was the most dysfunctional of the governments. You would rather be in Honduras than in Brazil. And so So that kind of melted down. That was out of my control as well. It's not like I was the guy bribing people at Petrobras. I had no idea all this stuff was going on. So that was out of my control. The one thing that I blame myself for was when I looked at these numbers, I made the assumption that what Vale reported as earnings reflected the iron ore price for that year. That when they reported the earnings for 2013, it reflected the iron ore prices that come down to 50, so it already reflected the iron ore price drop. And what I discovered with Vale is there's almost a two-year lag between when iron ore prices drop and earnings drop. So iron ore prices drop, but the earnings kept dropping even after the iron ore prices stopped dropping because it was a two-year lag. By the time this entire process played out, Vale's operating income had gone from $15 billion down to $3.5 billion. That's something I could have learned if I'd spent more time looking at the history of Vale, because part of the reason there's a lag is they actually lock in prices using forward markets. So until those forward contracts run out, you actually don't see the drop in earnings. And I could have seen that if I'd looked back in time and made a serious calculation of how long does it take between the time prices change in both directions and income reflects it. Not, I can't get my money back saying I've explained away the answer, so give me my money back. It's too late. But I can learn from it. So next time I value a commodity company, I will look at the history of the company to learn from leads and lags. But again, the point I'm making is all you can do is value a company at the point in time you're in. And there are things out of your control that will come in and sometimes make you lose money. And remember, sometimes you can make money for all the wrong reasons. Don't complain about it. You just got lucky. Call it skill. It's always what makes you feel better, makes everybody around you feel better. But the reality is, a lot of what happens here is out of your control. Yes?
Is there currently a lag for oil companies?
Yes. And varies across companies, especially the smaller oil companies. The larger oil companies tend not to hedge. So the Exxon Mobils and the Royal Dutches, you see the effect much more quickly. But as you go down the scale to the smaller oil companies, there's often, depending on the company, maybe a year and a half to... That's why many of them look better than they really are, because they've been able to report reasonable operating income and revenues even in the face of dropping oil prices. But that, you know, that shoe's waiting to drop. And you know, as an investor, you've got to watch out for that. Yes?
So professional investors...
So I'm not a professional investor? Is that what you're saying? Anybody who invests money to me is a professional investor. So when you say professional, you're talking about mutual fund managers and stuff?
So a former BlackRock guy told me this. So he made decisions based on three factors. Stock price, performance, and investor
yeah. Sentiment is a pricing factor, right? So if you're trading,
yes.
Sentiment matters,
right?
If you're investing, sentiment is out of your control. So basically, it's not part of it. Macroeconomic factors. Have you ever seen an economist be good in its macroeconomic forecast? I don't even know why we waste our money asking these guys what will happen in the future. So my point in macroeconomic forecast is I'd love to know what interest rates will be a year from now. I could make a ton of money. But I've never, ever found anybody who's actually been consistently good at forecasting macroeconomic factors. So I would love to, but the track record of people who invest based on macroeconomic factors is abysmal. Why? Because almost impossible to forecast too many things. The middle factor is what I end up with, because if I don't want to go with sentiment because I'm an investor and I'm not good at forecasting macroeconomic variables, what am I left with? Just fundamentals. That's what intrinsic valuation is. But if he's a BlackRock guy, I don't even know why he lied. You should have just said, I invest based on sentiment. No, that's basically it. That's really it. And then you got to create this noise of, I look at the fundamentals. Why are you lying? Just say, looked at the mood. The mood looked good. I bought because everybody else was buying. I can predict what BlackRock will do based on what the stock price has done over the last 6 months. That's a sentiment, right? So a lot of, when you say professional, that's why I kind of, because professional in the sense, I'm not sure what that means. But in the sense you run mutual funds or hedge funds, a lot of them are traders. They play the pricing game. They talk the value game, but they play the pricing game.
They have to play the pricing game.
Because they're judged on a pricing basis. I don't blame them, because they get judged on a pricing basis, right? Yeah, so the whole thing is a pricing game. So my problem is not that they price things, but that they maintain this patina of caring about value. And my point is just shut the heck up. I'm being polite. Just stop talking about growth and cash flows. I know you don't care. You know you don't care. Why? No, preserve this for your clients who might not know. Let's just talk about what's really driving your investment decisions. You're here because everybody else is buying, right? Tell me the truth. Yes. Okay, let's create a cover to make it look like you bought it based on a discounted cash flow valuation you did for the company. But a lot of professional investors are pricers, and you can see why. Why are investment bankers pricers? Right? Yeah, why are realtors prices? What's your job as a realtor? It's to get deals done. You get commissions only if the house gets sold. How does an investment banker get money? Once the deal gets done. If you're driven by transactions, you have to price. Again, I understand why investment bankers price things. It's because they have to get transactions done. You don't get judged on good deals and bad deals. You get just judged on deals. So pricing is the name of the game. So what I'm talking about is really valuation, and people might talk, but they don't walk the walk. Yes, Ashton. What market? That's just market debt over market equity. The same thing you're computing for your companies. No, it's just basically their market debt to equity. Yes, Maya. Well, remember what I'll talk about it. Next page actually will give you the answer. I made it up, but it's made up with a constraint. In fact, I'm going to give you four rules to keep the terminal value in constraint. Yes. Yeah, I don't even know how that happened. That was, so one of those numbers is wrong. I don't know which one. Maybe that's the reason I bought the stock. No, unfortunately not, because I don't think it's going to make enough of a difference. It should be whatever I compute as the cost of equity, right? So let's talk about the rules to follow when you compute terminal value. The first is, this is a growth rate you're going to maintain forever, right? So how high can that growth rate be? It's got to be less than or equal to the growth of the economy. In fact, I have an even more rigid rule that serves me well. You don't have to use it. I actually use my risk-free rate as my proxy for the growth in the economy. So I say, if my risk-free rate is 1.75%, I'm not going to let the growth rate be higher than that number. Respect the cap. The reason I say that, in the case of Disney, the risk-free rate was 2.75%. I set the growth rate at 2.5%. And I will not go above 2.75% no matter what, because I'm going to be tempted. You know what the temptations are going to be? It's a global company. It's going to grow in China. It's this, it's that. Because really what they want me to do is go a little bit above 2.75, about 2.8, 2.85. This is one of those things, is once you get past 2.75, it's going to be so easy to wander. So I know my behavioral instincts are going to be to wander, so I cap it at the risk-free rate. Second, once I make this company into a mature company, I have to start thinking about the rest of it also looking like a mature company. Right now, Disney earns a 12.61% return on capital. Why? Because lots of growth opportunities, theme parks it's building. But once it becomes a mature business, I would expect that return on capital to decrease. Maybe to the cost of capital, maybe to a little above, but I have to think about it seriously. And the case of Disney, when I thought about it, I believed it would decrease, but I believe that their competitive advantages are so long-term and so long-standing that I'm going to leave it just above the cost of capital, at 10%. Third, I have to reinvest enough to sustain my growth rate. Remind me again how much I'm growing the company at in perpetuity? 2.5%, right? And what kind of return on capital am I assuming? 10%. Remember, growth is reinvestment rate times return on capital. So if the growth rate is 2.5% and my return on capital is 10%, I need to reinvest 25% of my after-tax operating income every year forever. So my reinvestment rate reflects my growth rate. And the final assumption I have to make is my cost of capital in stable growth should be the cost of capital of a mature business, not a high growth business. In the case of Disney, the change is not dramatic because it's already a pretty mature business. But can you imagine how much different it would be if I were valuing Twitter? where the cost of capital will be 12% right now, but once I make it a mature company making money, that cost of capital could be 8%, but give it the cost of capital of a mature company. So let me review the four rules. Respect the cap. Don't let the growth rate exceed your risk-free rate. Think about excess returns in perpetuity. And if you're at all concerned about that number being high, push it to your cost of capital. Reinvest enough to sustain your growth rate and give your company the cost of capital of a mature company. That's FCFF's simple Ginzu spreadsheet that I said. If you look at the bottom of the spreadsheet, there are some defaults. You know what the defaults do? They enforce these rules. But I'll let you change it. Because if you don't change the rules, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to push your cost of capital to that of a mature company. I'm going to push your growth rate to the risk-free rate. I'm going to push your return on capital to the cost of capital. And I'm going to make sure that you're at least internally consistent in your terminal value calculation. Roy. It's not a proxy. The growth of the economy is the cap. You can't grow faster than that. So it's not a proxy for the growth for your company. So your growth can be lower than that number, but it can't be higher. So if you want to set it at 1.5, you want to set it at 1, you can set it at 0.5, you can set it at 0. You can even set it at a negative number in perpetuity. I'm okay with that. You just can't exceed that growth rate of the economy.
Okay,
yeah.
My question is,
doesn't matter. Use global growth then. Don't allow, there are no excuses. None. So if you have lots of growth in China, then use a longer growth period. Right? Don't push up the growth rate in perpetuity. That's not the place to go. Back there.
So I understand how I'm passing the economy, but a question on your proxy. Why do you use risk-free instead of equity?
Equity risk premium has nothing to do with growth. The risk-free rate actually is a proxy for growth. Equity risk premiums have nothing to do with the growth rate.
Well, why would you assume that the economy goes to 2% when S&P 500 implies it's growing?
No, earnings can grow faster, right? Earnings have nothing to do with the growth rate of the economy. The growth rate of the economy reflects how much your production, the GDP, grows on a year-to-year basis. So everything you're going to see in equity earnings is going to be a levered number. It's going to reflect fixed costs. So in good years, your equity earnings are going to grow much faster than the economy. In bad years, are going to do much worse. So, and equity risk premiums have nothing to do with equity earnings anyway, right?
So you're saying if the value of all companies goes up 10%, that's not the economy?
That's on the value of the economy, but it's not the growth in the economy. Because if you use that for a proxy, we should have been growing. The economy should have been growing at 11% a year for the last 80 years, right? The actual growth rate of the economy is about 1.5% or 2% in real growth terms plus inflation. So we know there's a gap between what happens to market value of companies and what the growth rate of the economy is. One can't be the proxy for the other. Okay. Yes?
What if there's a divergent correlation between interest rates and the economy?
You said what do you mean by divergent?
The Fed keeps putting down the potential.
Does the Fed actually push the rate? What did we say with the royal rates? Why are the rates low right now? It's because Janet Yellen moved the interest rate lever. Rates are low because inflation is low and growth is abysmal. That's it. The Fed at the margin can come in and nudge that number. But the Fed doesn't set rates. If the Fed set rates, we'd never have had 10% rates in the late 70s, right? The Fed likes to send the impression that it sets rates. Yeah. What it sets is the Fed funds rate. I don't think it does. To be quite honest, if you look at the last 5 years, you plot out inflation and real growth each year, you get almost exactly the T-bond rate graph. Okay. So let's say you get this cost of capital, you get you project the cash flows, you discount back at your discount rate, you come up with the present value. It's a climactic moment, right? You got the present value. You might be pretty close to your end game or pretty far away depending on what you've taken the present value of. Let me explain. If you've taken dividends per share and discounted back at the cost of equity, you're done. This is it. This is your value per share. If you've taken collective free cash flow at equity for the whole company, discounted back at the cost of equity, what you have is the total value of equity in the company, which you now may have to divvy up between common stockholders and option holders if there are management options outstanding. But if you do what I'm going to plan to do with Disney, which is take cash flow to the firm and discount it back at the cost of capital, what you valued is the operating assets of the company. See, what are you talking about? Remember what I started my free cash flow to the firm calculation with? Operating income, right? So the only assets I valued are those assets whose income is part of operating income. Let me not be mysterious. I haven't valued those assets whose earnings don't show up as part of operating income. Like what? The case of Apple. The $220 billion in cash. The income from cash is not part of operating income. It shows up below the operating income. I've got to add that cash because if I don't, I'm leaving it on the table and that makes no sense. That's the easy part. So you've got to add back cash and marketable securities because it's not been valued yet. You know what else I haven't valued? I'll give you an example. I take Yahoo, I project the free cash flow of the firm, I discount back at the cost of capital, I come up with a value of $4 billion. If I'm lucky, that's what I'll come up with, $3 to $4 billion. The stock is trading at $35 billion. This is awful, right? But what am I missing in my valuation? The holding in Alibaba and the holding in Yahoo Japan are both classified as minority holdings, which means the accountant doesn't count the income from those holdings as part of my operating income. You see, how much could they be worth? They're worth about $35 billion. That's a big chunk of penny change you left on the table. So you have cross holdings, you've got to bring them into the process. Then you subtract out debt, you come up with the value of the equity. And if you've granted options to managers, remember that's a share of equity you've given away. And that's one thing to think about. Anytime you hire an employee and say, you can have equity options, that's nice that you're giving him the options to make him or her stay. But that'll also mean a piece of the equity has been given away. I'm going to take that out of the process before I compute the value per share. So what I'm going to do is take you back to the easiest of these valuations, which is a pure dividend discount model valuation. And I'm going to do this on Deutsche in early 2008. So it's a dividend discount model. So all I'm focused on is dividends. Remember I said I'm going to give them 5 years. So basically what I started with is I started with that growth rate I projected based on their return on equity and their retention ratio. That's a five-year average number of 5.4%. And I said, this can't be a stable growth rate. It's too high. How did I make the judgment that it was too high? What did I compare it to? I compared to the risk-free rate. The risk-free rate then was 4.5%. I said at 5.4%, I can't assume it's stable growth, so I've got to allow for a growth period. I'm not going to get crazy and give them a 50-year growth period or a 20-year or even a 10-year. I gave them a 5-year growth period of 5.4% growth a year. So what you're going to see is net income growing at 5.4% a year for the next 5 years. Each year, I'm assuming that they pay out exactly the same percentage of net income each year, 54% a year. That gives me dividends each year. I discount the dividends back at my cost of equity based on the risk-free rate and the beta that we already computed. And everything's done in euros. The value of just the dividends for the next 5 years on Deutsche is 9.65 euros. Don't stop there, though. That's just the dividends. At the end of 5 years, what happens? The company becomes a mature company. If it's a mature company, I've got to give it a growth rate that reflects that of a mature company. So let's go through the rules. So it's got to be less than what? The risk-free rate of 4.5%. I gave it a 3% growth rate. Why only 3? Because the economy is growing at 4.5%. I would expect the more mature parts of the economy to actually grow at less, because otherwise, where will the high-growth companies go? The growth rate that I assumed in perpetuity was 3%. But I'm not quite done. I've lowered the growth rate. I've made Deutsche into a boring company. Let me give it the nice things that come with being a boring company. What's the first thing that's going to happen if you become a boring company? Your beta will start to move towards a beta for the market. So the cost of equity is going to decrease to 8.5%. You're a boring company. You make pretty much your cost of equity as your return. So your return on equity, I'm going to assume, in stable growth, is going to be 8.5%. See how assumptions are being layered on top of assumptions? You can't stop. You have to make assumptions. There's no oracle out there that you can go as a, oh, great oracle, what will the return on equity for Deutsche be 5 years from now? And if you do get an answer, it's probably a lie. You have to make your best judgment. That 8.5% return on equity, if I can maintain it forever, means that they can pay out about 63% of their earnings as dividends. So here's what I look like. Look at what I see at Deutsche in this valuation. For the next 5 years, they're going to grow 5.4% a year, pay out 54% of their earnings as dividends, and have a cost of equity of 9.2%. After year five, they're going to have a lower growth rate, 3%. That's the bad news. A lower cost of equity and a higher payout ratio. That number, after year five, is what I use to compute my terminal value. So to get my terminal value, I start with the net income in year six, the 5,143 grown out at 3%, with my new payout ratio, because after year five, I'm going to go to the new payout ratio. And I get a terminal value. at the end of year five of 62.3 billion euros. I'm almost done. But that's at the end of year five, right? So I have to bring it back to today. And here's one of the things that confuses people in valuation. To get that 62.3 billion value, I used an 8.5% cost of equity, right? But to bring that 62.3 billion back to today, I revert back to my high growth period cost of equity. You're saying, why? What do I need to do to get to the terminal value? I have to live through the next 5 years, right? And during the next 5 years, I have a lot of risk, and I have to factor that in when I discount the terminal value back. You add that present value, you get a 49.7 billion of that plus the dividends. You just divide by the number of shares. The value per share that I got was about 105 euros per share. The stock was actually trading at 89. Griffin?
For that first margin and dividends, yeah. Did you just look at those current years?
No, it actually used the 5-year average. That's what the payout ratio was. If you remember in the, when I did my growth rates, I gave you two choices for Deutsche. It's the 5-year average. So in a sense, I'm being consistent. Whichever payout ratio I use to get my growth rate is the payout ratio I've got to assume, and I project out the dividends. Yes? Actually, I wanted to buy, but I was too lazy. I kept putting it off, and then September 12th came around, and I said, thank God I didn't buy. So it was pure accident I did not buy. It wasn't actually, you know, undervalued enough for me to jump in and do anything rash because it was basically the, you know, change the return equity a little bit. So I didn't end up buying. I did end up buying in 2013 though, after this valuation. And you're going to see what's different. In this valuation, I've shifted away from dividends. And I explained why in the last session, right? You don't trust banks. You don't trust the managers. You can't trust dividends. So I've replaced dividends with free cash flow at equity. This is the calculation I showed you last session where I subtracted out the reinvestment and regulatory capital to get to my free cash flow equity. Everything else is the same process. I projected out for 5 years. And notice the free cash flow equity is negative for the next 3 years. So what am I assuming is going to happen at Deutsche? They'll have to raise fresh equity. Why? Because they're undercapitalized. It's built into the model. I discount the cash flows back. The value that I get in 2013 with free cash flows to equity was 62 euros per share. The stock was trading at 35. I did buy. I've made some money, but not as much as I'd like to, but that's always the case. I just like being greedy. Okay? But this is a case where I did forecast out, in my valuation, they were having to raise capital to cover the regulatory shortfall. It's built into the valuation already. Let me do one final valuation, and then we'll end for the day. I took Tata Motors, and I said, okay, I'm going to try to do a valuation of Tata Motors using the free cash flow equity. Why free cash or equity rather than dividends? Dividends are only for desperate people when you can't estimate cash flows. If you can estimate cash flows, just use the free cash flows. So these are free cash flows equity using an expected growth rate of 24.13%. We talked about that's the number from 2013. I used the cost of equity. And these are all rupee numbers. So I'm doing the valuation in Indian rupees. There's my present value of free cash or equity for the next 5 years, 127 billion rupees. At the end of 5 years, I tip them into mature growth again. So remind me again what I need to do. They can't keep growing at 24.83% and be a mature company, so I had to bring the growth rate down. I brought the growth rate down to less than 6.57%, and that's the nice thing about connecting to the risk-free rate. The growth rate I'm going to use for Tata Motors is 6%. He's saying that's so high. It would be high if I were doing a US dollar valuation, but remember, it's an Indian rupees, higher inflation. What one hand gives you, the other hand takes away. That 6% growth is what I built in perpetuity. I did assume that their return on equity will drop to their cost of equity. Unlike Disney, where I thought the company would continue to make more than the cost of capital, I don't see that happening in the automobile business. There's my terminal value, 2.28 billion. I discount that back to today using today's cost of equity. Again, I have to live through the risk of the next 5 years. What I get as a value per share is 275. And the price was 425. And I'm going to end today's session by asking you a question. When you look at the 275 and the 427, clearly the first two companies I showed you were undervalued, and they asked me, did you buy? With Deutsche, I said no. With Vale, I said yes. What's the analogous question you're going to ask me on this one? Did you short? And my answer is not in this lifetime. You're saying, don't you feel I feel as confident in this valuation as I was in the previous valuations, but what's the difference? Why was I so willing to buy when I found something undervalued, but I'm not as willing to sell short? Yeah. I'm sorry? I don't know when the price will adjust when I buy either, but how long can I hold? Until my spouse finds out what we've invested in. But I fixed that. I turned off all our brokerage accounts to paperless, so nobody knows what's in there. So I can hold as long as I need to. So when I buy, I control my time horizon. When I sell short, what happens? I borrow somebody else's shares. I have to return them, usually within 3 months, 4 months, 6 months. That's the asymmetry in investing. When something is cheap, you can buy and hold. When something is expensive, there's no analogous long-term way in most stocks. There are some where you have leaps, long-term options of taking advantage of an overvaluation. Okay? I'll see you on Monday. Make sure you send your summary in to me.
That go with the webcam, it's going to be old data. That's probably what's happening. I'll just stay with the record. You do capital structure. Anytime you see a 2016, it's not good. I'm going to walk up. Why do you walk up?